Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. The great decoupling has finally occurred, with Russia suspending its participation in the New START arms control treaty. Russia and the West have gone their own separate ways. And in the process, arms control appears to be dead in the water. More troubling times ahead. Crosstalking decoupling, I'm joined by my guest, Ted C. in Tasmania. He's a conflict consultant and a retired U.S. Foreign Service officer. In Paris, we have Jean Bruckmont. He is a political commentator. And in Berkshire, we cross to Christopher Elali. He is a political analyst and researcher. All right, gentlemen, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Let's go to Ted in Tasmania first. Ted, I mean, I'm sure all of you saw the two speeches, one that Vladimir Putin gave to the nation, an annual event, and Biden's appearances in Kiev and in Warsaw. And you couldn't get more juxtaposed. Biden is on an ideological crusade. There's no sense of causality. There is no context. There's not even really a goal. The Russian president talked about why Russia's in this conflict. It's about geopolitics and security. And you can't get more diverse than that. And this is one of the reasons why I think the West is misunderstanding why the conflict started in the first place and why it continues. Your thoughts, Ted.
Well, I think, Peter, the problem that we continue to see is that the West refuses to listen to Russia, has completely ignored Russian red lines for many years now. And the real difficulty right at the moment, I believe, is that unlike former U.S. presidents who weren't listening to the president of the Russian Federation, we now have one who can't listen because he's not mentally quite there.
That's a very good point there. Jean, the same question to you is that this is one of the reasons why this conflict is construed in radically different ways. Again, Russia is talking about security. And right before the conflict on December 17, 2001, they said, look, here's what we need. We need to talk about these things. And they were completely blown off by Washington and by NATO. And here we are. And Russia's goal is to end this when its security has been assured. Nobody in the West seriously wants to talk about it. The French president, if it's an odd day or an even day, I can't really tell. He flip-flops back and forth here on this issue here. But until both sides can get on the same page, this conflict isn't going to come to an end. Go ahead in Paris.
Yes, well, I think you have to put this conflict in perspective in what happened over the 20th century, which is mostly the process of decolonization or de-Westernization. It started in 1920 with the Baku Congress and the appeal to the people of the Orient, which was launched by Lenin and the Bolsheviks, calling for them to be decolonized because they realized the revolution in Europe was impossible. And that certainly appealed to people like Mao Zedong and Ho Chi Minh and started the one part of the process of decolonization. The second stage was the Bandung Conference in Indonesia in 1955 and the beginning of the Non-Aligned Movement, which launched a new stage for the final completion of decolonization in Africa and elsewhere. And also the creation of countries that would be independent both from the communist bloc and from the West and from the United States. And that went along rather well, I think. But of course, with the collapse of the Soviet Union, the Westerners have had, have been dizzy with success, to use a phrase used by Stalin during the collectivization. They became dizzy with success. They thought that there's a new thousand-year Reich in front of them, and they're going to control the world. And that was, of course, the neoliberal period and the recolonization of part of the world and the interventions in Yugoslavia, Iraq, et cetera, et cetera. And now they have run into something really difficult, which is Russia. Russia is not Iraq, it's not Syria, and even Syria wasn't a success, and even Afghanistan was not a success, but certainly Russia is much more resistant. And the main change linked to the war, I don't want to discuss the war itself, is the rapprochement between Russia and China and the fact that the rest of the world, including India, which has been hostile to China for many years, and of course Latin America and Africa and so on, are getting closer to this new Moscow-Beijing axis. And that, of course, is the most significant event of the last year, in my view, irrespective of what's going on in the ground in Ukraine. It's a new stage.
That's such an excellent point. I mean, this program is about decoupling, but basically it's a battle of narratives. Let's pull in Christopher here. Christopher, it's fascinating what Jean had to say, because this is the West continues to want to recreate the world in its own image. And they hit a brick wall when it came to Russia. Russia said, no, we're not going to go along with that. And the rest of the world is taking, a good part of the world is taking that cue, is that, no, we will not follow your rules-based order, what other mumbo jumble you want to throw at us here. There is a breach. There's a significant breach here, and it's having a knock-on effect. The global South is not reacting to the West wants. Obviously, China isn't, and India is a wild card here. There's a lot of things in play right now. Christopher, go ahead.
Basically, you have to look at the past, few decades to understand. After the collapse of the Soviet Union, it's not like the U.S. And its European partners and NATO all of a sudden were, going out and generous to the global South and generous to others. Instead, they did the opposite. They went on the warpath. They destroyed Yugoslavia. They went eventually into Afghanistan, into Iraq, into Libya. They've destroyed Syria. They've gone through countless countries and just wreaked havoc and devastation. So everybody else is watching this over the past few decades and saying, this is coming for us. Not only Russia and China, the DPRK under, first under Kim Jong-il and now under Kim Jong-un, they're watching and they're saying, absolutely not. We're not going to believe that they have our legitimate interests or that they care about our sovereignty and our territorial integrity. They don't. And so ultimately, over the past few decades, Vladimir Putin has tried persistently to call for negotiations, to call for diplomacy, to call for something to happen. And what you've seen is further encroachment, further expansion by NATO. And so, of course, Russia has an important part in its national defense and its national security, which is its strategic depth. It can't allow NATO to come right to the border just within a few hundred kilometers of its capital and its major sites. So ultimately, when you're looking at this, when you're looking at the two speeches, you not only see two narratives, you see two completely different visions of the world, one under hegemony of the West, one under US, EU, NATO imperialism, and the other with a new multipolar world where people have respect for the sovereignty, the territorial integrity, and the internal affairs of all the respective countries. And this is coming to a head-to-head here.
Go ahead, jump in, Jean, go ahead.
Well, Thursday this week, which is today also, but Thursday this week, the Chinese have released a paper about hegemony, criticizing all aspects of European American hegemony. I have not had time to read it, but certainly I hope there will be another crosstalk about that, because that seemed to be...
Well, Jean, you're reading my mind. Let me go to Ted here on this here. I mean, the rest of the world is watching how the United States deals with its close ally, Germany, and the Nord Stream pipelines. I mean, if that's how America treats its friends, how is Russia, America and its allies going to treat foes? I mean, the Western media doesn't want to talk about it, but Seymour Hersh is the greatest living journalist of our time, and he's being ignored. By the New York Times, by the way, where he used to work here. But that event, blowing up those pipelines, has ramifications that I think even the people in the White House have no idea what they've unleashed. Ted, go ahead.
Peter, I'll be the first to say that Seymour Hersh hasn't got everything he's written correct in a long and always interesting career. But this time, I've worked with Jake Sullivan, I've worked with Toria Nuland. Everything he wrote rings true to me. I think he got this one right. In fact, I know he got it right, but the fact that it's now in a public source and available to people without sort of hiding behind classifications means that the narrative is crumbling at light speed, that pretending that it was anyone other than United States Special Forces that went in and did this act of destruction and damaged Europe for decades to come. Thank you very much. You can safely ignore everyone. You can safely ignore the official narrative. The truth is out.
Yeah, well, Christopher, I mean, this was an act of international terrorism, okay? If the United States didn't do it, then who did? It's kind of like the O.J. Simpson trial, okay? I mean, if he didn't kill his ex-wife and friend, then who did, okay? Christopher.
I think, first and foremost, now that Cy Hersh has written this article, We've been saying it for months now.
Yep.
We've been saying that there was no possibility, no way that Russia spent billions of dollars to create this pipeline and use it as part of their diplomacy, their rapprochement with Europe, the building, the mutual sort of agreements and success of all of the entire continent. And all of a sudden, they're going to go and destroy their own pipeline? It doesn't make sense. But of course, instantly, you know, part of this reality that we're now living in, we were the ones spreading misinformation and disinformation, quote unquote. We were the ones spreading, Kremlin propaganda. It wasn't Kremlin propaganda, and it isn't. It's just a reality that Russia would not do this. It's not within, it is just out of the bounds of what would be realistic. And now that Cy Hirsch has written this, I think it's taken the lid off of cocktail that the West is making in their mainstream media. And people are finally seeing and waking up and saying, maybe we're being duped, not only on Nord Stream pipeline, but on everything and connected with a variety of issues, whether it be the operation in Ukraine or, for example, the balloon going over the U.S., the spy balloon.
Jean, go ahead. We have 40 seconds before we go to the break. Go ahead, Jean.
Peter, do you remember that they mined the harbors of Nicaragua during the Sandinista time?
Yeah.
I mean, they were even condemned by the International Court of Justice, and they never paid reparation. But that's pure gangsterism. They used to do it to the South, and now they do it to Europe.
Well, I mean, to all three of you in our audience here, weapons of mass destruction, does that ring any bell for anyone here? I mean, if they lied about that, then we have to safely assume that they lie about a whole lot of things, maybe about everything. We'll ask Ted when we come back from the break, because he used to work in the belly of the beast itself. All right, gentlemen, we're going to go to a short break, and after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on decoupling. Stay with RT. Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter LaBelle. To remind you, we're discussing decoupling. Okay, let's go back to Ted in Tasmania. Ted, you said something quite tantalizing in the first part of the program, that you've worked with the likes of Jake Sullivan, and you believe that they were very much involved in this plan to destroy the pipelines. Can you give us a little bit? I mean, that's kind of a tease and not very fair to me or our viewers. Explain yourself.
Well, let's just say that everything that Hirsch wrote about the two of them being involved with the planning and execution of this operation rings true, having seen them in action when I was with the U.S. mission at NATO.
Okay, well, that's not a lot of detail, but we're going to take your word on it. Okay, let me go back to Christopher. Christopher, you know, there's all this talk. I look at the pages of, you know, like Responsible Statecraft, Antiwar.com, even American Conservative, and they talk about some kind of negotiated end. What is there to negotiate? I mean, Russia's already made it clear what it wants to have happen. And until the West reacts to that, I don't understand what these negotiations are all about. And, oh, by the way, a ceasefire? Well, why would Russia agree to a ceasefire so NATO can build up Ukraine again and they do it 5 years from now? I mean, all three of you, you know what really disappoints me is that a lot of smart people over the last year have said really stupid things. I expected more from them. Christopher, go ahead.
No, I would say that you're absolutely correct. And not only that, but Putin has been, and the Russian government and Lavrov have been saying this for years and years. Nobody's been listening. Russia's security concerns have been at the forefront of all their major speeches, of all their diplomatic overtures, and it hasn't been acted upon. And the reason is that the U.S. and NATO are not really concerned and not really in any way willing to give even an inch to the Russians, because that's not part of the war machine's plan, because you need to have the enemy. You need to have, and Russia is no longer communist. Russia is no longer the Soviet Union. But you see how they reproduce this language now. They reproduce it because they need that enemy, because their stockholders in these big military industrial complex, you know, corporations, they need it. They need it because they need to make more armaments, more missiles, more planes, more ships, whatever they need. So I think ultimately when you're looking at this, what negotiation, what settlement, what ceasefire can come from a conflict where one side does not respect the national security interests of the other side, nor its overtures in saying we don't want a belligerent military alliance at our border that is a relic of the Cold War when we disbanded the other part of that military alliance, you know, the one in opposition to it. It doesn't make sense. There can be no negotiation, no settlement of this current crisis unless the U.S. and NATO and their European partners take seriously Russia's security concerns and advocate for a Ukraine that won't join NATO, that will be neutral, and that won't be a breeding ground for all of the things that are being concocted in Washington and in Brussels and in the halls of power in the West.
Yeah, well, John, if we're going to put our money on Annalena Baerbock, I think we're all in really big trouble, okay? John, it was interesting, news cycles ago, the former vice president of the United States, Pence, was on Fox News, and he referred to Russia as the Soviet Union. And that's just the problem. They keep saying they still think in that paradigm. They think in a Cold War paradigm here. And I could tell you, living here for a quarter of a century, they have dispensed with that paradigm completely. It's the West that continues to embrace it. Go ahead in Paris.
Well, I think there is one continuity with the Soviet Union is that the current Russia, not Yeltsin, but Putin and the others, they are anti-hegemonic. They don't like this idea of a unipolar world. And the Soviet Union was against it too. And that's what made it popular in the rest of the world to some extent. And I think it's also what makes Russia popular in the rest of the world to some extent, because they take the lead of the revolt of the global South against this unipolar world, this American hegemony, this American exceptionalism, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that in that sense, there is a continuity. I agree that there is no continuity as far as the socioeconomic or the political system is concerned. But there is this mentality, which I must say I praise the Russians for, is that they reject this American hegemony, which the Europeans, the Western European at least, embrace. But then, of course, that I think is the main continuity, if you wish, and the main reason for this intense hostility to Russia that we have in the West.
Well, there's another continuity. It's Western hegemony. That has not changed here. Ted, you know, in looking at what's coming out of the administration and from NATO's Stoltenberg, I mean, they're sending out a really wide array of messages. There's no more ammunition. We don't know how much more aid we can give. But then Biden is saying as long as it takes still. And it seems to me that the messaging is getting kind of sloppy on their part because the narrative is beginning to crack. Your thoughts. Go ahead, Ted.
Absolutely agree, Peter. I think there's a note of desperation creeping into that messaging, quite frankly. Look, in NATO, we're dealing with something that shouldn't have existed 1 minute longer than the Soviet Union did. It's never had a purpose after the end of the Soviet Union. It never will have a purpose. Everything they try and come up with is frankly a nonsense. There's never been consensus within NATO to agree before the recent conflict that Russia was the enemy. And even now, they haven't officially placed Russia in their core documents as the enemy. And there's a good reason for that, because frankly, there is still some reasonable, you know, straight thinking people in Europe. I wish I could say the same about Washington right now. This whole situation is one of the West's making, obviously. NATO keeps searching for a reason to exist. NATO reminds me in that sense of the scientists at the US nuclear laboratories who, since the first discovery of nuclear winter back in the mid-80s, when global arsenals got built down from sort of 70,000 nuclear weapons down to the sort of mid to low teens of thousands of nuclear weapons, the scientists could sort of put up with nuclear winter back in the 80s because they still had a lot they could do and still maintain their pensions. These days, the threat from nuclear winter to the nuclear establishment, the nuclear weapons mafia, the big nuke cartel, as I like to call it, and that's manufacturers, that's government departments, that's everyone involved, is existential, because we can't afford to have tens of thousands of nuclear weapons around. We can't afford to have tens of hundreds of nuclear weapons around because we're this close to the apocalypse, even if nothing pops off in Ukraine. And in that sense, those, you know, the Los Alamos National Laboratory scientists are preserving their own careers the same way that NATO and its infrastructure is without a reason to exist.
That's the biggest problem. Christopher, you've already kind of touched upon it, but, the juxtaposition could not be more clear. I mean, NATO is a business model. I mean, it's about generating budgets for expenditures, okay, on weapons that don't necessarily even have to work, actually, okay? But you get a budget to get the next year's budget bigger than the one before. I mean, it's all about driving its preservation and wasting other people's money, okay? Because I don't think the Americans are going to send their big tanks there. You know why? Because they'll be destroyed immediately after they cross the border. And they know that, okay? But, you know, if you're to promise 50 tanks, then you got to order 50 more tanks. Hey, everybody, you understand how this works? Go ahead, Christopher.
I absolutely agree. And actually, it was Noam Chomsky years ago who said that the only reason for NATO's survival afterwards was really to maintain and control world energy supplies. And so you look at all the wars. Don't forget, NATO was involved in the overthrow of the government of Muammar Gaddafi in Libya, actively involved in destroying that country, actively involved on the ground with the U.S. effort in Afghanistan, providing support as part of coalitions for other campaigns, securing shipping lanes and things like that against the quote-unquote pirates and who knows what. So I think ultimately their purpose, and the way I see it, is similar to how others have seen it, which is as an imperialist arm. It's sort of the imperialist armed forces of this unipolar and hegemonic global structure. So when you look at it in that sense, you understand that as it continues to expand. And don't forget, it's not only in Europe. Colombia is a quote-unquote global partner of NATO. They're trying to bring in other partners in, for example, Oceania. So you're looking at this and you're saying, this really is the global reach of
But Christopher, isn't it really obvious to you is that these mandarins, the West, they want to do? They want to short circuit the United Nations. They want to have their own global coalition of the willing. And NATO doesn't want to have any, or the United States doesn't want to have any restraints put on it here. I think that's very much part of it. And I also agree, you're absolutely right. A great deal of it is directed at energy here. We're almost out of time here. Ted, you know, as far as what will it take? Go ahead. Jean, you want to jump in? Go ahead.
Well, I just wanted to say that if I look at the peace movement in the West, in France or even Germany, et cetera, or Belgium, I mean, you know, they first of all condemn, of course, the Russian intervention and Putin, it's all Putin's fault, et cetera. Then they condemn to some extent NATO, but they never said what Russia should do, both for its security and also, most importantly, in my view, for the security of the Russian people who live in Ukraine. I mean, either we have to believe that the people in Donbass and Crimea actually want to be Ukrainian under the present Ukrainian regime and have been forced to be Russian by Russian troops, which I think is totally unbelievable, or else we have to realize that these people should have rights. Why should Ukraine right of independence in the Soviet Union be sacrosanct, but the right of self-determination of the Russian people who have been put in Ukraine at the time of the Soviet Revolution have no rights whatsoever, and it doesn't make any sense. And that's something which is totally ignored by our so-called anti-war movement.
Well, apparently, if you're the rally, I think you're making reference to in the United States. If you're against the war, then you're a Putin puppet and you're a white supremacist. But Ted, the United States and NATO countries are supporting essentially at least Nazi elements in Kyiv that no one wants to talk about in the West. We have 20 seconds. Go ahead, Ted.
Okay, Peter, for 20 seconds worth of fun here, let's think what the West could do to make a difference in the war in Ukraine right now. Is there something of value that NATO has in Europe that it could give away in return for, say, negotiations commencing between Russia and Ukraine for a peace settlement? We have to think really hard about this, but if it were me, I'd be looking at the nuclear gravity bombs that the U.S. maintains in Europe for no good reason.
Okay, that's ending on a very depressing point. Thank you. All right, gentlemen, that's all the time we have. I want to thank my guests in Tasmania, Paris, and in Berkshire. And thanks to our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. Remember, Crosstalk Rules.